It was 27 years ago that I first entered a prison. As a young newspaper reporter in Albany, I drove up to Dannemora near the Canadian border to interview a convict who had started serving a 14-year maximum term for heroin possession. He was black, a three-time loser. I'd never met him face-to-face, but I'd written stories about him, after which he'd been convicted and sent away for a long time. I felt guilty. New York's embattled prison system was reeling from the bloody Attica uprising that had occurred a few months earlier, and getting into the 116-year-old Clinton State Correctional Facility for an interview had required me to obtain the inmate's formal consent, the warden's verbal okay, and the commissioner's written permission, as well as my editor's approval. Upon arriving, I was asked to sign my name on a register and produce my personal identification. Then I was fingerprinted for the first time in my life, one set to go to Albany's Criminal Identification Bank, another to be sent off to Washington for J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Then I was x-rayed, hand-searched, and sharply questioned, treated, it seemed, like a criminal myself. Doors clanged behind me, beefy guards watched. As one steel gate after another clamped shut in my wake, I felt strangely afraid, powerless, and imprisoned, wondering if I would ever get out. I met my prisoner in the lawyer's interview room, which in those days provided little privacy. Accompanied by a stern-faced corrections lieutenant, Jimmy Parker was wearing greens and sneakers. He looked older than I had expected. His eyes were bloodshot. He took every cigarette I offered. Through our brief meeting, I tried to get him to tell me what he knew about police corruption back home, but he wouldn't squeal on anybody, admitting nothing except that he missed his son. I left without the story I had sought, but I was spurred to find out more about the justice system that had singled out a black hustler for long-term cold storage while passing over so many others who seemed to have committed worse crimes. As an adventurous young investigative reporter, I believe prison to be the ultimate stonewall, the cover-up of cover-ups, the darkest scoop, precisely because the inner workings of the penal system appeared so physically inaccessible in secret. I was challenged to see if I could get inside and intensely curious to discover what prisons were really about. To try to find out, I enrolled in a graduate school and began studying all about criminal justice. And one day I joined in a class trip to another fabled maximum security institution, Great Meadow Correctional Facility in rural Washington County. After a long ride, we crossed a frozen barge canal, along which stood the warden's stone mansion, and beyond it, ugly as sin, the prison itself. As an academic, I was allowed to explore some parts of the institution that journalists never got to see. Suddenly, I was peering into horrific mental observation units where naked madmen raved, strolling past tiny open-faced cells that displayed one infamous criminal after another, many of them sitting on bunks in their underwear, doing push-ups on the stone floor, writing letters, or sleeping. Great Meadow was crammed with 1,350 inmates, most of them blacks or Puerto Ricans from New York City, 200 miles away. Yet all 600 or so staff members, and indeed virtually all of the entire county's free residents, were white, rural antipodes. Here was the warden, a relic from another century, who gruffly said he'd already served 41 years inside prisons, and then he proceeded to instruct his visitors on some of the finer points of prison administration, such as, quote, how to handle the coloreds, our escorts, a succession of stone-faced guards, seemed uncomfortable with university types, and responded to our questions with only a word or two, particularly when inmates were around. Then we talked with some convicts. At first, only two or three. Quickly, there were more. Some were the same impassioned black militants who had been on television during the Attica Rebellion the previous September. Here they were, complaining to anyone who'd listen about how badly they'd been treated. One of them, Champ, held forth as smoothly as a skilled lawyer arguing his case. Several students were mesmerized. Somebody whispered they couldn't believe he was the prisoner and the other fellow was the warden. The sight that left the deepest impression was set off in a corner of the prison grounds, where a lonely chimney belched putrid smoke into the frigid air. It came from one of the decrepit industrial shops, the soap factory. Entering it that bitter cold day, I went from below 0 to 80 degrees above in one step. The first gasp seemed to glaze my throat and guts with slime like shampoo, and when I breathed, bubbles seemed to appear. White officers stood around, bellies hanging over their belts, looking disgusted. The prisoners' muscular black bodies glistened with sweat as they stirred the huge, bubbling cauldrons of boiling lard. And as they stirred, the prisoners sang. And the lyrics that day in 1972 sounded like old Negro spirituals. Somebody later remarked that the songs had probably been brought north via prison camps and other institutions from their origin on southern slave plantations. This scene and its connections would not leave my mind. I became fascinated, began to study prison seriously, putting aside my journalistic career to study for a doctoral degree, plunging into libraries and fieldwork, reading everything I could. Having decided that I needed some inside experience, I took a position as a research analyst, and over the next 20 years, I held several high-ranking posts in state government that gave me unusual access to prison operations and criminal justice policymaking. All the while, I continued to study and reflect upon the history of American imprisonment. The infusion into Virginia of kidnapped children, maids, convicts, and Africans, all to work as servants on the plantations, marked the beginning of a pattern that would continue for nearly two centuries. By 1650, most British immigrants to colonial America went as prisoners of one sort or another. Some were forcibly kidnapped or arrested, a legal distinction which is difficult to prove, particularly for those seized and shipped here against their will. Some were tricked or enticed into giving up their liberty. Others bound themselves as servants in order to avert execution, starvation, imprisonment, or boredom. There were some significant distinctions between indentured servants, transported convicts, slaves, and seamen or soldiers compelled into military service, but all of them qualified as prisoners since they were deprived of their liberty to leave. British America was not the first penal colony. Many earlier empires had used transplanted prisoners to cultivate foreign plantations, dig mines, and perform other manual labor. Starting in the early 17th century and continuing for 150 years, an organized international prisoner trade, of which the African slave trade was one important part, provided the foundation for England's colonial wealth and America's identity. To the extent that American history is the story of immigration, then American colonial history is largely the story of the immigration of prisoners. Convict vessels. After a convict had been pardoned and the transportation order signed, he might languish imprisoned for as long as 3 or 4 months until a ship was ready to carry him away. When that time finally came, the inmate was brought out to the prison yard in irons and chained to a line of fellow transports. Soldiers with fixed bayonets ensured there were no shenanigans. Coffles of as many as 100 men and women were prodded out through the gate, clanking over the cobblestones in a wretched-looking train heading toward a waiting ship. All along the narrow route, curious crowds formed to watch them pass. Dogs barked, and boys tossed mud and stones. Among one such group were Anthony Carnes, convicted of stealing goods valued at 40 shillings, Timothy Featherstonehaw Scutt, convicted of taking 2 letters from the post office, Henry Port, imprisoned for taking 10 pence worth of goods, and Edward Coleman, who had ripped a lead pipe from a house belonging to the East India Company. Shabbily dressed, often looking haggard and sick, with sullen or contemptuous expressions, most transports were young men, although as many as a fifth were women. Nearly all of them had been convicted of small-time theft. Very few were professional criminals from London's underworld or persons of consequence. Middle Passage. The next shock in the ordeal of the kidnapped Africans began when the prison door was opened and they were pulled out naked and afraid into the bright light. Men, women, and children were herded into separate groups. It all happened so quickly that the men barely had time to recover before guards bound their necks and ankles with heavy iron chains and started pushing them toward the beach. Many inlanders had never seen the sea before, and they were filled with wonder. Astonishment turned to terror as the white guards shoved them into boats and brushed and pushed off from the shore, heading toward a huge vessel with tall masts waiting in the harbor. In a few minutes, they were being hoisted aboard. 30 years later, the former slave Equiano remembered thinking at the time that he was entering a world of bad spirits and that they were going to kill me. Many feared being eaten. And when he saw water boiled in a large copper kettle and a multitude of black people of every description chained together, every one of their countenances expressing dejection and sorrow, he was so horror-stricken that he fainted on the deck. Plantations. Isolated from its neighbors by wide stretches of open fields, dense woods, and running water, the rural southern plantation was a prison without walls, self-contained, stratified, paternalistic, coercive, a society unto itself with its own laws, rules, customs, and language. Plantations varied in size from a couple of dozen acres to vast tracts of 30,000 acres or more, containing anywhere from a few to a few thousand slaves who ranged in age from newborns to wizened old folks. A mid-18th century visitor who approached from the long and dusty road leading to one Savannah estate described coming to an opening occupied by a miniature palace, elegant in its exterior and embellished by the most refined taste, in the midst of a noble plantation and surrounded by a little village of Negro huts. During the American Revolution, many people have forgotten that there was a terrible experience of imprisonment, and in fact, more Americans died in prison than died in battle. In fact, more Americans died on one prison ship of the American Revolution than were killed in all the battles of the Revolution. That ship, that most infamous ship, HMS Jersey, was anchored in a small channel in the East River called the Wallabout, roughly 100 yards from the Brooklyn shore and across from the lower tip of Manhattan, near the future site of the New York Naval Shipyard. Built in 1736, she'd seen extensive action as a warship, first as a store ship and later as a hospital ship, with the Solo Bay and the Strombolo. Then in 1779, stripped of her masts, sails, and 60 guns, her ports boarded shut, with even her lion figurehead and rudder ripped away, her barnacled hulk was put to use as a receiving ship for captured privateers and other rebel prisoners. A vessel of 1,000 tons measuring 144 feet in length, with a beam of 41 feet and a depth in her hold of 16 feet, the Jersey was designed for a crew of 400, but now held as many as 1,200 prisoners under shocking conditions. In the daylight, the ship could be seen from shore, hundreds of forms looking like stunned insects, some of them waving their gaunt arms, covered her upper deck and bowsprit. Shortly before sunset, her sentinels became visible, and any approaching visitors could make out only occasional moving shapes inside the hold through tiny air holes that ringed the ship. Those coming closer were suddenly struck by a hideous stench, and many had to cup their hands over their faces to keep from retching. Voices inside the hulk cried for water or for news as the latest arrivals were brought up a ladder and through a heavily guarded barricado door, then lined up on the deck and searched. State prisons in New York, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere were not created exclusively for blacks, but they were designed to arrest and counteract slavery's traits without ending slavery itself. Some of the barriers to slavery's abolition were also among the forces pushing the growth of imprisonment as a punishment for crime. Sentiments such as the fear of large numbers of free blacks, a perceived inability to accommodate large numbers of newly liberated slaves in a free society, racial prejudice, fear of radicalism, revolution, the need for a cheap and servile labor force for the state, the fear of crime. As a convenient means of forcing compliance, obedience, and performance, imprisonment remained crucial to the control and conditioning of free Negroes and other members of the labor force. Prison was intended to improve on slavery by eliminating slacking and economic inefficiency. It offered a setting that in some ways resembled slavery, but minus certain distasteful features such as sexual licentiousness, irreligiousness, idleness, and unjustified captivity. Prison silence would replace plantation singing. Masters would now erect walls to keep the captives in, the opponents out, and the do-gooders in check, leaving it to the great masses of the general public to only imagine what horrors lurked inside. Instead of being bred on plantations, these prisoners would be kept celibate and prevented from multiplying. Rather than being enslaved, not for any fault of one's own, but for being a member of the Negro race, convicts now would be committed pursuant to conviction of a specific crime. Who could quarrel with that? Except in cases of particularly serious offenses, individuals would not be held for life, only for a set term of years. Persons would no longer be born into bondage. They would have to achieve it by their own illegal deeds. Individual masters would no longer own slaves, perhaps inherited with a livestock. Now all citizens would relinquish such ownership to the state, and the state would serve as master and keeper. Such was the modus operandi of the new state prison. Before the state prison was invented, imprisonment had entailed all sorts of pains for convicts. but sexual abstinence was not necessarily among them. In the past, many prisons routinely had allowed inmates to be joined or at least visited by their wives or by prostitutes. Indeed, many holding rooms, as they were called, had not been segregated by sex or policed to prevent sexual activity. Blacks and whites, young and old, healthy and ill, married and chaste, all were thrust together in the dark and in the light, sometimes beyond earshot of any prudish keeper. As a result, early jails and prisons often were the scene of raucous and sometimes promiscuous intercourse between prisoners and their spouses, prisoners and other prisoners, prisoners and keepers, and various combinations thereof. But this changed in the late 18th and early 19th centuries when enforced sexual deprivation became a standard feature of penal policy. Convicts were cut off from their families, including spouses, barred from having any physical contact with another person. Now they were segregated by sex, often to such an extent that a male prisoner might spend entire years without ever seeing a woman or hearing her voice. Mates were torn from each other. Inside the prisons, the sexes were kept separated. Closer surveillance was introduced to prevent any sexual liaison, and so sexual deprivation became another cardinal feature of American imprisonment, joining other entitlements like the denial of liberty, loss of goods and services, and the loss of security and autonomy. But prison sexual policy went further. Taking a cue from the gradual emancipationists and sanitizing the sordid sexual arrangements of slavery, creators of the state prison demanded sexual abstinence from predominantly youthful males who were at the height of their sexual needs and at an age when they would normally be most likely to procreate. Sexual incapacitation of such young men and women was more than a denial of pleasure. It was a method of birth control in an age that lacked contraceptive options, a way of restricting and controlling the population growth of an otherwise fecund and troublesome class who in future generations threatened to become still more dangerous and costly to maintain. Above all, the state prison promised to sever sexual relations once and for all between the keepers and the kept, ending generations of sexual licentiousness and rape by slave traders, masters, and overseers, the kind of conduct that had given slavery a bad name. Eastern prisons' most astute observer was a 30-year-old English novelist, Charles Dickens, who visited the institution on March 8, 1842. Like Beaumont and Tocqueville, he toured the penitentiary's dreary passages under official escort, sometimes pausing to hear the profound silence that was broken only by the faint, almost imperceptible sound of a lone weaver's shuttle or the taps of a shoemaker's hammer. He spent a whole day passing from cell to cell, talking with inmates. The first man he saw was working at a loom. Convict number 1066 wore spectacles and a paper hat. When addressed, the man paused for a long time and spoke very deliberately. He said he'd been there for 6 years and was due to remain three more. Convicted of receiving stolen goods, second offense, insisted he wasn't guilty. Dickens noticed the fellow had painted some figures on the wall, including a female form over the door, whom he called the Lady of the Lake. Dickens noticed his lip trembled when the subject of his wife was raised, after which the man shook his head, turned aside, and covered his face with his hands. "Time is very long, gentlemen, within these four walls," he said. Far into the block, pungent smells drifted from the vicinity of an inmate who apparently was allowed to keep rabbits in his cell. When he was called into the sunlight, the prisoner appeared haggard and unearthly pale, and he was clutching and stroking a white rabbit at his breast. Dickens thought his manner resembled a rabbit's. He found others. A strong black man who had been born a slave and imprisoned for burglary, a just arrived English villain who Dickens felt would gladly have stabbed him if given the chance, a swarthy mariner who wrote poetry, a fat old Negro whose leg had been amputated in the penitentiary and who was being attended by a fellow inmate who was an accomplished surgeon, a 13-year-old colored boy, three beautiful, young, light-skinned black women, all convicted of conspiracy to rob the same man, a mulatto sailor, number 58, looking helpless and crushed, who had been imprisoned there upwards of 11 years. Now, near the end of his term, he was addicted to peeling the skin from his fingers. Walled in, Thoreau spent only one night in Concord's jail. What he later described in his essay was not wholly unpleasant. The prisoners seemed reasonably contented and well-treated. The jailer pleasantly introduced Thoreau to his roommate and locked their door as if to respect their privacy. The room, freshly whitewashed and simply furnished, was probably the neatest apartment in the town. His roommate showed him how to get along. Within a few hours, Thoreau had read all the tracks that were left there and examined where former prisoners had broken out and where a grate had been sawed off, and heard the history of the various occupants of that room. "For I found that even here there was a history and a gossip which never circulated beyond the walls of the jail," he said. He later described his experience as like traveling into a far country such as I'd never expected to behold. To lie there for one night, it seemed to me I had never heard the town clock strike before, nor the evening sounds of the village. I'd never seen its institutions before. This was one of the peculiar institutions, and I began to comprehend what its inhabitants were about. The next day, to Thoreau's surprise, he was released. It seems that somebody had interfered and paid his delinquent tax. During his brief incarceration, no great changes had taken place on the village common, such as might have happened if he'd gone in as a youth and come out as an old man. And yet, he viewed the town, the state, and the country differently. "I saw yet more distinctly the state in which I lived," he wrote. "This may be to judge my neighbors harshly, for I believe that many of them are not aware that they have such an institution as the jail in their village. By a former custom of the village, a poor debtor coming out of jail might be expected to be greeted with a little salute in which his acquaintances would peek at him through their fingers, which they would cross like a barred window." Transformed by his experience, Thoreau felt he was regarded as if he'd been on a long journey, and history would record that he had. Prison camps during the Civil War, prison camps on both sides, were incredibly lethal. Indeed, the performance of the military in designing, operating, and supplying prisons during the Civil War proved to be worse than the record of the civilian authorities, even more horrific than that of the slave traders and plantation owners, who, after all, had economic incentives to treat their prisoners better. According to War Department figures released in July 1866, the North held a total of 220,000 Confederates, and the South had held 126,000 Unionists. Of these 26,000 Southerners, and 23,000 Northerners died in prison camps in less than 4 years. To put the matter in perspective, roughly 2.5 times as many soldiers were imprisoned as were involved in the Great Battle of Gettysburg. Yet the prison camps killed nearly 10 times as many as did the battle. Political prisoners. The night before their scheduled execution on August 23rd, 1927, with hopes of a last-minute reprieve virtually exhausted after 7 years of fierce struggle, a huge rally was held near the prison with Sacco's wife, Rosa, and Vanzetti's sister, Luigia, on the speaker's platform. Catherine Ann Porter, the writer, later recalled watching as the two timid women faced the raging crowd, mostly Italians, who rose at them in savage sympathy, shouting, tears pouring down their faces, shaking their fists, and calling childish phrases their promises of revenge for their wrongs. Never you mind, Rosina. You wait, Luigia. They'll pay, they'll pay. Don't be afraid. Rosa Sacco spread her hands over her face, but Luigia Vanzetti stared stonily down into their contorted faces with a pure horror of her own. They screamed their violence at her in her own language, trying to hearten her, but she was not consoled. She was led away like a corpse walking. The crowd roared and cursed and wept and threatened. The American maximum security prison was intended as an institution of total control, an island of totalitarianism in a sea of freedom. Originally designed as a detention device to deprive human beings of their liberty, the prison had withstood the mob from within and without to become one of the most formidable weapons in the arsenal of democracy, an apparatus that had changed less and prevented more change than any other institution in American society. Over the years, the state had refined its design into an art, adding massive walls that might extend 30 feet below ground and just as many in height above a seamless asphalt floor, sally ports at the gate that enabled guards to inspect the undercarriages of passing vehicles, specially reinforced steel bars that could withstand assault by man or time itself, transparent screens to block an anguished kiss between a convict and his spouse, elaborate locking systems that sealed their occupants inside and kept intruders out like watertight compartments that kept the sea from surging into a battleship's hold, strategically placed canisters of tear gas that could be instantly set off to quell a disturbance, and multi-tiered cell blocks that allowed a few passing guards to closely inspect hundreds of men in their cages as they slept, read, paced, or defecated. Such were the cumulative contributions of a long line of custodial generations. It was at this time that Malcolm Little threw himself into the Koran. After lights out, he would feign sleep as the guards passed by his cell and stay up late into the night reading and studying. He read about the African slave trade and the slave master's rape of black women that had produced mixed race Negroes, light-skinned like his mother, who looked white and was ashamed to speak of her own father. He discovered how the devil had brainwashed blacks to believe that whites were superior, and he learned about how white slave masters had injected Christian religion into their Negroes. In his dimly lit cell, he scrawled a one-page letter of faith to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and dropped it in the mail. To his amazement, he received a neatly typed personal reply that welcomed him into the faith and said that the black prisoner symbolized white society's crime of keeping black men oppressed and deprived and ignorant and unable to get decent jobs, turning them into criminals. Elijah Muhammad neglected to mention that he had come out of prison himself, just as Malcolm had gone in. But his response offered encouragement. It had a $5 bill attached, too. And by the time Little was paroled in August of 1952, he'd served 7 years in prison. Shortly after regaining his freedom, he dropped his slave name and became Brother Malcolm X. In time, he became a Muslim minister. When his recruiting had drawn thousands of new believers, Elijah Muhammad appointed him minister of Temple No. 7 in Harlem. To be a convict in the United States prison system had sweeping legal consequences. Inmates were not entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. A prison did not allow the establishment of religion. A prisoner did not enjoy the free exercise of religion or freedom of speech or of the press, or the right to assemble peaceably or to petition the government for a redress of grievances. A con could not keep and bear arms, nor could he bar anyone from quartering in a cell. Prisoners didn't have the right to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, nor were any warrants required supported by oath or affirmation or particularly describing the place to be searched or the persons or things to be seized. Inmates could not be penalized without due process of law, and just compensation was not required when their private property was taken from them in prison. They lacked the right to a speedy and public trial for their alleged prison infractions, much less the right to a hearing by an impartial body. They weren't entitled to be informed of the nature and cause of informer's secret accusations against them, nor did they have the right to confront any witnesses against them or to compel witnesses in their favor, nor to have the assistance of counsel for their defense. Their right to be free of cruel and unusual punishments was blocked by the prison walls. They couldn't vote for president or vice president or any other office. They couldn't hold public office. Under the 13th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, the status of persons duly convicted of crime remained that of slaves. Still does. And finally, prison is reputed to be one of the least successful institutions in modern society. But the fact that it has survived for so long, so intact, suggests otherwise. That it's been reproduced so widely indicates it's performed some important functions. That is not to say that imprisonment's functions have remained the same throughout history or that they have stayed narrow or limited. On the contrary, imprisonment has served many purposes in American society over the last 500 years, and its multifunctionality has contributed to its ubiquity. Prisons are chameleons that have adapted remarkably well to their changing environment. Unlike other dinosaurs, they appear immune to extinction.
You've just heard Scott Christensen reading excerpts from his book, With Liberty for Some, 500 Years of Imprisonment in America. Christensen's talk, a presentation of the New York State Writers Institute, was recorded on December 10, 1998, at the University at Albany, State University of New York. Our thanks to Scott Christensen and the New York State Writers Institute for permission to record and air this interview.